Okay.
So, we've arrived at one of the great centers of Buddhism, Sarvati in the Jetavana Monastery. Not just the Jetavana Monastery, there's also another monastery close to here. It's actually just another place where the Buddha spent Vedic priests called the Pugarama, the Eastern Grove. And that was donated by none other than Visakha, the foremost female disciple of the Buddha. So this is the place where most of the heroes you read about in Buddhism either live or they stay. This is the most, probably the most important place in the sense that the Buddha spent most of the time here. And we're just going to read out from the Venerable Dhammika's description about Sarvati and the Jetavana Grove. It's a very beautiful description. The fair capital of the Kosalas excites the mind, charms the eye, gives the ear the 10 sounds, and provides food enough for all. An old saying. Sarvati, the capital of Kosala, was said to have derived its name from the fact that everything was available there. Sabang Ati, as I have mentioned today. And it was indeed one of the wealthiest and most vibrant cities in the middle land, the Ganges Valley. The Buddha visited Sarvati several times before finally making it his headquarters in the 20th year after his enlightenment. From then on, he spent every rains retreat, except his last, the 24 vasas in a row he spent here. The greater part of his teaching career was spent here. From then on, he spent every rains retreat, except his last, in the environs of the city. And where did he spend his last rains retreat? No, not Rajagaha. Vaisali, yes. I mentioned that when we went to Vaisali. That was the place he spent his last rains retreat, and after Vaisali, he walked over many months to Kusinala, where he passed away. But Vaisali was his last rains retreat. 24 before then, in a row, was spent here. And he visited here many other times as well. He had probably decided to limit his wanderings at this time due to advancing age, and no doubt he chose Sarvati as his base because of the generous support given to him by the city's wealthiest merchants. While in Rajagaha on business, Anatha Pindaka went to visit his brother-in-law, whom he found so preoccupied with making arrangements for a feast that he failed to welcome Anathapindika in his usual friendly manner. What is the big occasion? Anathapindika asked. A wedding? A visit by the king? His brother-in-law replied that he was preparing a meal for the Buddha and his monks. Simply hearing the word Buddha filled Anathapindika with such joy that he expressed his desire to go meet this Buddha then and there. Being told that now was not the proper time, he decides to go and see the Buddha the next day, first thing in the morning. So overjoyed was Anathapindika at the rare privilege of meeting a fully enlightened human being, and so expectant was he that he woke up 3 times during the night, thinking it was near daybreak. Finally, he set out before dawn, but as he left the town and entered the jungle, he realized that it would still be some time before light appeared, and he began to get frightened. He hesitated and considered turning back, when suddenly a spirit appeared, illuminating the whole area and encouraging him to continue. Anathapindika met the Buddha in the early morning light, and later Anathapindika invited the Buddha to spend the next rains retreat in Sarvati. The Buddha agreed, making it clear that he expected Anathapindika to provide him and his monks with a quiet place to reside in during his stay. Householder, the Buddha tells Anathapindika, the Tathagata delights in empty places. I understand, Lord. I understand, Sukhata. When Anathapindika arrived back in Sarvati, he began looking around for a place to accommodate the Buddha. The most suitable place proved to be a pleasure park and our lama, just outside Sawati, owned by Prince Jeta. Anatha Pindaka approached the prince and asked him what price he wanted for his park. But he replied he was not interested in selling. Anatha Pindaka kept insisting that Prince Jeta name a price, and eventually, as much out of exasperation as to put him off, the prince quoted an unrealistic high price of 100,000 gold pieces. To his astonishment, Anatha Pindaka accepted, and soon servants arrived with carts full of gold coins, and he began spreading them on the ground. At this point, Prince Jeta relented, realizing how determined Anatha Pindaka was to have this park, and the rest of the money was used to build a large monastic complex. The Vinaya describes the complex as consisting of halls, monastery buildings, cells, porches, attendance halls, fire rooms, toilets, covered walkways for walking meditation, wells, bathrooms, lotus ponds and sheds. And in honour of the two men who were responsible for its coming into being, the place was called Jetavana Anatha Pindaka Arama, Jeta's world, Anatha Pindaka's path. In the coming years, several other equally large monasteries were built around Sawati. The Pubarama, the eastern monastery, now represented by a village, Canterbury, just to the east, and the Rajakarama. These were the two most famous, and it was in these monasteries and other locations around Sawati that the Buddha delivered most of his discourses. I will pause here to tell the story of Vaisakha and the offering of the Pubarama. The Vaisakha was a Buddhist, a very devout disciple of the Buddha, but she married a man called Nigara, which means a Tridia, who was not interested in Buddhism at all. So he forbade his wife, Vaisakha, for giving alms food to these monks, these beggars who came door to door. At which Vaisakha was very, very disappointed. In those days you had to be obedient to your husband. So she didn't know what to do. She managed to get this plan, this brilliant idea. She went around and telling all of her friends and relations that in her house, since she got married, she only can eat old food. And when her husband, Nigara, said, "What do you mean by sort of lying to your friends and by libeling me, saying we only eat old food? We get fresh food every day. I'm a rich man. What do you mean we only eat old food?" And Vaisakha said, "By food I mean the karma. We're only wealthy because we're eating the fruits of our old karma. We made good karma in the past, that's why we're wealthy now. We're only eating old food. We're not making any new food, any new good karma." And according to the story, that was enough for Nigara to understand the meaning. That offering food to the monks, and especially to the Buddha, was making good karma. And from that time on, he too became a Buddhist. And out of gratitude to his wife, he started calling her, not just wife, but mother. Because Vaisakha was his mother in the Dharma, which means that Vaisakha's other name was called Nigara Mata. She was not only the wife to her husband, she was also her husband's mother, Nigara Mata, the father, the mother of her husband. At one time she was going to go to a big ceremony, a big festival, just outside of Sawati, and so she was dressed in all her expensive jewellery. You've seen Indian women, they like to wear bangles and gold necklaces, and she had some very expensive ones on. But as she was going to this festival, she was passing the Jeta Grove, and she thought, "No, I want to go and visit the Buddha." And she realised that being so well dressed, with gold and bangles all over her, it was not appropriate to approach a monk, especially not the Buddha. So she took all of the bangles off. She wrapped it in the cloth and gave it to her maid, and so she approached the Buddha just in normal dress. And the Buddha gave such a beautiful discourse on Dhamma that she was so inspired, she left almost like walking on air. She forgot all about, and so did her maid, forgot all about her jewellery. And it was at that point that Ananda saw all this expensive jewellery in the monastery and asked the Buddha, what should we do about this? Because monks aren't allowed to touch gold and money, especially jewellery. And the Buddha said, in the case that something has been dropped or lost in the monastery, it is your duty to pick it up and put it aside for those who lost it. So even though as a monk I'm not allowed to pick up money, if you drop your wallet or your purse in my monastery, the monks have a duty to actually to pick it up and put it aside so that you can claim it later on. So that's one of the times when monks can pick up and touch money, when it's lost property in the monastery in which you reside. So Ananda put it aside. And of course Visakha soon found out that she lost or left her stuff in the monastery, so she went back to claim it. When she heard that her stuff had been touched by a holy monk like Ananda, she said, well, I can't wear this anymore. It has to belong to the monks, to the monastery. And then she thought, well, the monks can't wear jewellery, so what should I do with it? So she decided to flog it, to sell it, because it was given to the monks, and to use the proceeds to build a monastery. So she went around Sarvati, seeing if anyone would buy this jewellery. It was so expensive that no one could, so she bought it herself. And with the money, which she bought her own jewellery with, she built the Pubavana, the Eastern Monastery. When she decided to build it with all this cash, she wanted the monks, actually, to be the supervisors. And I mention this story because when we started building Serpentine Monastery, some people said it's not right that monks do any building, that they should actually just meditate or teach and let all the builders and the contractors do their building. But I always quoted this story because at that time, Mahamoggallana was put in charge of the building work. Now many of you know that Mahamoggallana was a monk with psychic powers. And the commentary which tells this story, tells in a rather funny way that because of the psychic powers of Mahamoggallana, the building was erected in record time. Because you wouldn't need like cranes and other lifting equipment when you got Mahamoggallana around. And so this great big building called the Visakha's Pubavana, they also call it Migara Mata Parsada, the palace of Visakha, the mother of Migara, her husband. And that became a favourite resort of the Buddha. I mention that because the sutra I'm going to read out in a few minutes is an extremely famous one, and that happened in the Pubavana in Visakha's palace. Not a palace, a monastery which she built for the monks with that money. So not only was this a place for Visakha and the Pubavana and the Rajakarana, many other things happened here. Of all the events in the Buddha's life that took place in Sarvati, the most celebrated, I don't know if this is actually true, the most celebrated, but it's one of the most celebrated. So many things happened here. And actually tomorrow, the first thing we do when we go into the Jeta Grove Monastery is to go into what's called the Nawa, the new Jetavana Monastery, built by the Sri Lankans. Well, they were one of the first to come here. The Burmese, I think, were also here very early. But in that sort of hall there, they've got a series of murals, pictures, and this is a wonderful place to take pilgrims when they first come here, because in those pictures there you've got very beautiful paintings of actually what happened, the major events which happened in the Jeta Grove Monastery. So instead of just having just talk, we now have what's it called, visual presentation, yes, both sight and sound, to be able to understand what happened there. And so all those stories are actually pictured on the wall. And I'm going to ask you, as we go from picture to picture, what do you think that event was? To see if you can get all of the pictures right. So those of you who are traditional Buddhists, it will test you out. And those of you who aren't traditional Buddhists, you'll be able to see those pictures and get a good understanding of the major events which happened either in the Jeta Grove or close by.
many, many famous stories which you've heard before.
But one of the most famous was the conversion of Angulimala. This robber and murderer had killed so many people, 999, that villagers in outlying districts packed their belongings and moved into the city. From each of his victims, he cut a finger and hung it on a string around his neck, hence his name, Angulimala.
Many of you have got mala beads, but I think they're made of wood. I'm sure that if there was any enterprising young kid, it might be, say, Angulimala necklaces.
Maybe I'll go a bit too far there. Meaning finger necklace. When the Buddha heard about this, he set out for the area where Angulimala was known to operate. Obviously within walking distance of here, but it would be in the jungles and the lonely roads. With a special purpose of meeting him. And all the people who saw the Buddha going in this area say, do not go on that road, that's where the fierce Angulimala goes. My goodness, people would only go in a huge caravan with soldiers. You can't go on your own, it's dangerous. On a lonely stretch of road, Angulimala saw the Buddha.
There's a bigger story to this, I'll read this out probably tomorrow night.
And began to chase the Buddha. But although Angulimala ran his fastest, he was unable to catch up with the Buddha, who continued to walk at a leisurely pace. In frustration and bewilderment, Angulimala called out to the Buddha, "Stop, monk!"
To which the Buddha replied, "I have stopped. Angulimala, you should stop."
And Angulimala, "What do you mean? You're walking, you haven't stopped. What do you mean?" And the Buddha replied that the Buddha had stopped killing and harming human beings, and that Angulimala should do the same.
And when that might sound ordinary to you, when the Buddha says these things, it goes straight to the heart.
And so the murderer threw down his sword and bowed at the Buddha's feet, asked to be ordained as a monk. And later Angulimala became enlightened. But afterwards he endured violence and insults, even after he was enlightened, at the hands of those who remembered his terrible past.
The full story will be revealed to you tomorrow night.
In the centuries after the Buddha, Sāvatthī declined. But the Jetavana,
the city declined, because obviously the centre of power moved to the Magadha, especially at Patna.
But the Jetavana continued to remain an important centre of Buddhism. When Phasian came to Sāvatthī, the city was no more than a small town.
Phasian, that was the first century? Or 400?
400, Phasian. The city was no more than a small town, already in decline, inhabited by only 200 families, although the Jetavana seems to have still been relatively thriving. Its gate faces east, and it has two chambers, before which stand two stone pillars. Those are the two Asoka pillars. Now they disappeared. On the top of the left pillar is a wheel, and on the top of the right one is a bull. The water in the pool is clear, the trees and plants luxuriant, and flowers of many colours make a lovely sight. Inside the Jetavana he saw a temple, probably the Gandakuti, which housed the famous sandalwood statue of the Buddha.
They did have statues in the 5th century.
The Jetavana monastery was originally, this is Phasian, the Jetavana monastery was originally 7 stories high. The rulers and citizens of many countries vied with one another in making offerings here, hanging silk pennants and canopies, scattering flowers and lighting lamps, which burned day and night without ever being extinguished. Then a rat carried off the wick from one of the lamps in its mouth, thereby setting fire to the flowers, pennants and canopies. The whole 7-story building went up in flames. The rulers and citizens of all the countries around lamented bitterly, thinking that the sandalwood image must also have been burnt. But 4 or 5 days later, when they opened the door of a small temple on the east, they were amazed and overjoyed to find the image had gone there, unscathed. Together they rebuilt the monastery as a 2-story building and moved the statue back to its original place.
Many of you who have seen the stories of the tsunami know that even in the tsunami affected places, the Buddha statues were unharmed when they should have been harmed. Buddha statues can be very resilient.
Fastian also tells us how moved he and his companion were to walk where the Buddha had walked, and the amazement of the Indian monks on seeing Chinese monks for the first time. Quote, on arriving at the Jetavana monastery, when Fa Xian and Tao Ching reflected that the Lord had lived here for 25 years, they regretted having been born in a far-off country. Of the companions who had travelled with them through many lands, some had to turn back, and some had died. As they gazed at the places where the Buddha could no longer be seen, they were deeply moved, and their hearts were filled with sorrow. The monks there came forward to question them. Where do you come from? They asked. We come from China, replied Fa Xian. How wonderful, explained the monks, that men from a far-off country should come all this way to seek the Dhamma. And they commented to each other, not from the earliest times have any of our teachers ever seen a Chinese monk here. Now they see Australian monks here. By Huin Xing's time,
century is he? 700, 800?
630s. The next Chinese pilgrim came. Both Sawati and Jetavana were deserted and ruined. Of the Jetavana, he said, the residences of the monks were wholly destroyed. The foundations only remain, with the exception of one solitary brick building, which stands alone in the midst of the ruins and contains an image of the Buddha. However, archaeological investigation shows that shortly after Huyen Xiang's visit, all monasteries at Jetavana were restored, new ones were built, and it continued to flourish right up into the 12th century, after which it was finally deserted in the Muslim invasions and swallowed up by the jungle. In 1863, using information given in Fa Xian of Huyen Xiang's accounts of their travels, the archaeologist Cunningham identified the Jetavana, which had come to be called Sahet, and also Sawati, which was called Mahet. He did some digging, finding an inscription that confirmed his identification, and returned again in 1876 to do some more. Excavations have been done on about half a dozen other occasions since then, the last time by Japanese archaeologists in the late 1980s. Today the ruins of Jetavana are surrounded by well-maintained gardens, and because few pilgrims or tourists visit the place, it has a particularly peaceful and undisturbed environment, with monkeys and peacocks sometimes seen amongst the trees and the shrubs. That's the story of the Jetavana. Now the actual teaching which I'm going to give out today was one, there's so many sutras, so many teachings were given by the Buddha here in the Jeta Grove or in these surrounds. It's very difficult to choose a sutra, but the one which is, we just talked about this evening just came up. We were discussing where it was given. It was given in Migara Mata's Pasada, in the Pubarama, the Eastern Monastery, so it's in this area. And it's one of the favourite sutras, the Sutra on Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing. That was given here in Sawati, the most beautiful sutra about meditation. And I'm going to read it out now. It also fits in with the change of schedule, because we're going to talk about meditation, the best instructions of all by the Lord Buddha, and those of you who inspire. After we finish and ask the questions, you can stay and pull what you've heard into practice. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in the eastern part. But before I actually continue the sutta, any questions about the Jetavana, what I've said so far? Yeah? The Buddha came from the word Bhujati, means to awaken. It literally means the awakened one. The concept was, it was somebody who had been awakened to the truth. Using the old simile of being asleep and suddenly being awakened from Bhujati. But also that Bodhi was like an enlightenment, an awakening. That's why we have the Bodhi tree, like the awakening tree.
Yes? Did the word Buddha pre-exist Buddhism? It did pre-exist the enlightenment of Siddhartha Gautama. People knew the word, but they didn't actually have anyone who actually, I think, claimed to be a Buddha. Other people like Jain, the Mahavira, claimed to be omniscient, or all-knowing. But he didn't actually, as far as I know, call himself a Buddha. But it was a pre-existing word. So when the Buddha said he was a Buddha, it wasn't inventing a new name, a new word. So that was an old word which people knew. Yeah, Nata Pindakos he knew. That was the word. The first time this guy was calling himself a Buddha. My goodness, that's something. Yes, the word was important to him. He heard it before, knew it before from somewhere. So it was in the common currency of spiritual people. But obviously no one else had claimed that title. When we go to Sarvati, so it's Sarnath, the next stop after this, we get the story of the five disciples. And when the Buddha said he was enlightened, they didn't believe him at first. And it was only said, look, I never taught like this before, have I? And they said, yeah, that's true. So they noticed something had changed. It was out of character for him to actually claim that. And of course, actually before then, the Buddha actually met a wanderer on the way to Benares. And I think the wanderer said, now, who are you? And he said, I'm the Buddha, the fully enlightened one, perfectly enlightened. And this guy just went away wagging his tongue, yeah, sure. And the first person ever believed him. So, you know, if you go around calling yourself a Buddha, most people wouldn't believe you, but that was the Buddha. So, is that a good enough answer? Any other question then? How can we answer the Anapanasati Sutta? Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in the eastern park in the palace of Migava's mother. The reason it's called a palace is Pasada. It literally means like a delighting place. It was because it was one single building, seven stories, for the monks with different rooms in it. So it'd be like a big vihara. Similar to the ones we've seen, the foundations, huge foundations. And in those days, they were called seven-story palaces, and sometimes rich people would stay in these. They'd also offer these to monks, like a big vihara where you'd stay. Usually the Buddha would sit actually on the top story. The top story is called the Hamiya, and like a penthouse, and that's where he would usually stay on the top. And he was staying there together with many very well-known elder disciples. Sariputta was there, Mahamoggallana was there, Mahakassapa was there, Mahakachana was there, Mahakotita was there, then Mahakapana was there, Mahachunda was there, Anuruddha was there, Revata was there, Ananda was there, and other very well known elder disciples. If you know like the stories of the Arahats, this was like the A-list, like the stars, like the superstars of Buddhism at the time, all in this one place. That must have been really something. For those in the Thai tradition, as a young monk, when I was on Tudong, I was visiting a monk called Ajahn Ben, and he was telling me that it was the birthday celebration of Ajahn Phan, who died some time ago. And so they said, do you want to go to this celebration? I went there and had all these famous Thai monks, all in this one monastery, all the great Ajahns of the area, were all on this little platform, maybe about sort of 5 meters square. And as soon as I went in there and saw all these incredibly famous monks, I thought, wow, it's like Buddhist Hollywood. You see all the major film stars, like the Oscars or whatever. And that's what it was like. Just all the wives you've heard about, they're all sitting up there, all together. So it was really moving for me. And this would have been even more so in this monastery, all these incredible great monks, all together in one place. Now on that occasion, elder monks had been teaching and instructing new monks. Some elder monks had been teaching and instructing up to 30 or 40 new monks. Now new monks, taught and instructed by the elders, had achieved successive stages of high distinction.
literally meaning jhanas and stages of enlightenment. You can imagine with all those superstars there, any young ones, wow, they got to, you know, the Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard, Yale University, all together in one place. They were great. Another occasion, it was the Mahapurana ceremony, the full moon day signifying the end of the rains retreat. And the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of monks. Then surveying the silent, it must be the huge Sangha of monks, he addressed them thus, "Monks, I am content with your progress. My mind is content with this progress. So arouse still more energy to attain the unattained, to achieve the unachieved, to realize the unrealized. I shall wait here in Sarvati for another month." Because of the great progress, you see, keep it going, I'm going to do another month. But also, it's very important here, he says, there is something to attain, there is something to achieve, there is something to realize. But he said, arouse more energy to attain the unattained, achieve the unachieved, realize the unrealized. The monks of the countryside heard around this area, the Buddha will wait at Sarvatin for another month. And the monks of the countryside left to come to Sarvati to see the Buddha. And the elder monks were still intensively teaching all these monks. All the monks were getting stages of high distinction. And on that occasion, the apostolic day, 1 month after Pavamana day, the Blessed One again was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of monks. Then surveying the silent Sangha of monks, he addressed them thus, "Monks, this assembly is free from prattle. It's free from chatter. It is established in the essence. Such is this Sangha of monks. Such is this assembly. Such an assembly as is worthy of gifts, of hospitality, of offerings, worthy of reverence. They are an incomparable field of merit for this world. Such is this Sangha of monks. Such is this assembly. Such an assembly that a small gift given becomes great, and a great gift greater. Such is this Sangha, such is this assembly. Such an assembly as is rare for the world to see. Such is this Sangha of monks, such is this assembly. Such an assembly as would be worth journeying many leagues with a travel bag to see. Such is this Sangha of monks, such is this assembly. In this Sangha of monks there are monks who are arahats, who have lived a holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and were completely liberated through final knowledge. Such monks are here in this Sangha. In this Sangha of monks there are monks who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there attain final nirvana. They will never return to this world. Such monks are here in the Sangha of monks. Anagams. In the Sangha of monks are monks who, with the destruction of the three fetters and with the attenuation of lust, hate and delusion, are once returners who will return once to this world to make an end of suffering. Such Aryas are here in this Sangha. In this Sangha of monks there are bhikkhus who, with the destruction of the three fetters, are screen winners, no longer subject to the lower realms, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. Such monks are here in this Sangha. In this Sangha of monks there are monks who abide devoted to the development of the four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness. There are monks who abide devoted to the development of the four kinds of striving, of the four bases of spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors. The people in this Sangha devoted to the development of the Noble Eightfold Path. Such monks are there here in this Sangha. In this Sangha of monks there are monks who abide devoted to the development of loving kindness, to compassion, appreciative joy and equanimity, are devoted to the meditation of foulness, meditation on impermanence. Such monks are here in this Sangha of monks. And in this Sangha of monks, there are monks who abide, devoted to the development of Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And that was the introduction. And now comes the mindfulness of breathing. Before I continue, any questions so far? The mindfulness of the breathing was said to be the meditation technique used by the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, and was the most popular meditation subject in the time of the Buddha and ever since. Now listen. Monks, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated,
It is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. Pause there. Because sometimes some people understand that anapanasati and satipatthana are two different types of meditation. That the thing that vipassana is called satipatthana. In fact, many people think that they're synonymous. To do vipassana is to do satipatthana. To do satipatthana is to do vipassana. However, this is not what the Buddha said. The Buddha said, and I'll read it out again, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four satipatthanas. So mindfulness of breathing is satipatthana meditation. It fulfills the satipatthanas. So if you do mindfulness of breathing, you can tell any monk you're doing satipatthana. Now the explanation. And how, monks, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? 1. Here a monk goes to the forest or to the root of a tree, to an empty hut, sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. That's number 1. Have some solitude, a quiet place. It does not say, go to the marketplace. Some Westerners say, oh, you can meditate anywhere. You can meditate in the market. You can meditate in your car as you go back home. This is not how the Buddha said. When you're a very profound meditator, fine. But you start in the quiet places, secluded places. You go to the forest, to the root of a tree, to an empty place. Sit down. Set your body erect. Establish mindfulness in front of you. And you know that the way I teach meditation, present moment awareness and silence, is what's meant by establishing mindfulness. In front of you means here and now. It means you have to be present. When you're talking to yourself, you're not being mindful of what's happening, you're being mindful of the description. There's a lot of difference between the words and the reality. There's a lot of difference between the menu and the food. The thoughts are like the menu, eating it is the food. You can give a dissertation about the taste of an apple. You can read all about it in the books, what an apple tastes like. But the best way to know what apple tastes like is to bite it. To taste it. That's the difference between the words and the experience. Which is why present moment awareness and silence is establishing basic mindfulness. Being aware. Then, mindful, you breathe in, mindful, you breathe out. Stage 1. Breathing in long, or breathing out long, you understand, I breathe in or out long. Stage 1. Breathe out, breathe in short, or breathe out short, you understand, I breathe in and out short. Stage 2. In those two stages, you don't have to do the one after the other. It's an either or. Well, it can be in the middle, neither short nor long. The point of this particular instruction, stage 1 or 2 of Anapanasati, is that by noticing the length of the breath or the shortness of the breath, it gives you something of interest to fix the attention on so the breath doesn't disappear so easily. It gives you basically something to do, something to notice it right. Yes. That is coming in the moment. How this relates to satipatthana. First of all, we find out what it is. Then afterwards, the Buddha would explain how you can say this fulfills the four satipatthanas. Okay. So you don't have to be do a long breath and a short breath. How long should I do the long breath before I start going on to the short breath? How long should I do the short breath before I can go into the next stage? This is not what is meant here. Either or, you just notice the length of the breath, or the shortness of the breath, as a way of
getting interest to make the breath a bit more interesting so you can watch it without it wandering off. Stage 3. I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of the breath. I shall breathe out experience the whole body of the breath. Thus you train yourself. The whole body of the breath means from the very beginning of the in-breath right to the end of the in-breath. The gap between the breaths being the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath. You fill your whole mind with the breath. That's what means the whole of the breath. The whole body of the breath, the whole group of the breath. Thus you train yourself. So this is when your mind is filled with the awareness of the breath. Nothing else. Number 4. You train yourself, I shall breathe in and breathe out, tranquilizing that breath. Here called the bodily formation, the kaya sankhara. You breathe out, in and out, calming that breath down. First of all, you get to know it, and then naturally it calms down. You don't have to decide to do this. If you want to, you can nudge it along by just saying calm, calm, calm. If you try and make it calm, you'll actually interfere with it and you'll get rough. You have to find out how does the breath become calm, and many of you know by now, you just leave it alone and it calms down by itself. In fact, the more you leave it alone, the quicker it calms down. That's how you calm it down. Number 5, I shall breathe in, I shall breathe out, experiencing rapture, pity. Number 6, I shall breathe in, breathe out, experiencing sukha, pleasure. And this is an important part of the breath meditation, 5th and 6th stages to experiencing bliss and pleasure as you are meditating. Sometimes people say if you have a happy time in meditation, you get attached, don't do it, that's wrong. But here the Buddha said this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be breathing in and out as you're meditating, experiencing bliss, happiness. This is what's supposed to happen. You're supposed to train yourself so this happens. The experience is, as it happens, is that you're meditating, your breath starts to calm down, you start to get peaceful, you start to get happy. And the sign that you've got pity sukha, these two coming together, is you're sitting there meditating, watching the breath, you don't want to go anywhere else, you're so happy just watching this breath, so content, so peaceful, so lovely. It comes down to dinner time, or it comes down to the time when Ajahn Brahm says, okay, time to get up now and go. You just don't want to go. And it's such a lovely time. Oh, this is so nice. It's a happy meditation. And this is what you're supposed to be achieving. Meditation is not torture, as that guide in the Lander said. Remember he said you go in his meditation and after the torture is over you can go upstairs and start studying. Now I don't study. Studying is torture. You go to university, get tested and have to read all these books. But meditation is completely opposite. He's got it the wrong way around. After you've studied and realise how stupid that is, then you can go and meditate and have good fun. So this is where the fun in meditation starts coming from. The pithi sukha. This is 5th and 6th stages in the Buddhist meditation. Breathing in and out, experiencing rapture and pleasure. This is pithi sukha. This is what happens, you get lots of bliss coming up. 7th stage, I shall breathe in and out experiencing this mental formation. It's a citta sankhara, this bliss is coming from the mind. It's a mental formation. So where does that bliss come from? It's not physical bliss. You don't feel it in your body, you feel it in your mind. Some actually meditators, sometimes if they start feeling bliss a little bit too soon, their body hasn't disappeared, and sometimes it does get into the body. I tell people in that stage, just go back onto the bed. Let go of the body a bit more. It's just too stuck on the body. And when you let go of the body, it's completely mental bliss. You don't feel it in your body, you feel it in your mind. This is the 7th stage. Breathing in and out, experiencing the citta sankhara, the bliss, the mental formation. And lastly, I shall breathe in and out, tranquilizing that mental formation. Calming it down. Quietening. So it becomes a very subtle bliss. Very beautiful. Even more intense, but not as coarse. The next stage, number 9. again, is very important. I shall breathe in and out, experiencing the citta, experiencing the mind. And I shall train myself. And of course, most people, if they're scholars, they've never meditated before, and they haven't got no experience in meditation, they think, what is this mind you're supposed to experience? You notice, as you practice this path of meditation, after the bliss starts to come up, well, I usually call it the beautiful breath, associated with the breath, first of all, but turning into a mental breath. This is actually important in the stage of breath meditation. Sometimes the breath seems to disappear, you're left with this beautiful peace, wonderful state. This is actually how the mind sees the breath. It's a mental formation of happiness. And as that starts to calm itself down, the next thing which arises is this nimitta, this beautiful light which appears in the mind. And of course it took me a long time to realize that that was this ninth stage of anapanasati. This is experiencing the citta. It's actually read in the books there. I should have seen it in the books, but it wasn't really well explained to me. The citta, this is what that nimitta is, a reflection of your mind, the citta. This is the first time you see the mind. All the clues are in there. The Buddha actually says, this mind is prabhasa, it's radiant. When there's no defilements, then this is where you start to see a radiant mind, it's beautiful light. That's a reflection of your citta, of your mind. So if you want to know what the citta is, at that stage in anapanasati, the breath has disappeared, this beautiful light comes up, that's the citta you're facing. So what do you do next? Number 10 and 11, I shall breathe in and out, gladdening the mind, I shall breathe in and out, concentrating the mind. That's the translation here, number 10 glyph. The words are for gladdening the mind, abhipamojaya. Literally means like making it bright, making it more beautiful. What sometimes I call like shining up your nimitta. Making it more bright, making it more brilliant, more beautiful. And samadhanamitta, not concentrating the mind, because concentration is the wrong thing, stilling the mind. So the two things when a nimitta comes up, first of all it might be too dull, it might be beautiful but not really, really awfully, not a powerful nimitta. And number two, it might be moving all over the place. If it's moving all over the place, it needs to be stabilized, made still. That's called samadhanamitta. What's said here, concentrating the mind, stabilizing the nimitta. And the other one is brightening it up, making it more powerful. And those are the steps you have to do with working with your nimitta. So brighten it up, it's usually one of the best ways, I've mentioned this before, is to keep good precepts, to be generous, to be pure-hearted. Or to do things like come on pilgrimage to the holy centers, because that really brightens up your mind. You get energy, sometimes from inspiration, sometimes energy from the place itself. That's why many of you have got good meditation when you've come here. Your mind has been brightened up, sometimes by the inspiration, but sometimes by other forces, beautifying and empowering your mind. And the other thing, samadhanacitta, to quiet it down. That's when I gave this simile to someone earlier. It's like you're looking at yourself in a mirror. If you look at yourself in a mirror and you find the image in the mirror is moving, it's a waste of time trying to hold the mirror still. It's not the mirror's fault. It's the one who's watching is moving. So the only way to samadhanacitta, to calm that nimitta down, to stabilize it, is to have the one who's watching become more still, to do less, to move less. This is where you start to let go of the will, the doer. It's called letting go. Not letting go out there, letting go in here, letting go of controlling, doing, willing, managing, driving your meditation. Then you'll find the nimitta becomes stable. That's the 11th stage, and now we come to the 12th stage. I shall breathe in and out, liberating the mind, vimochayan chittan. Liberating it from what? Liberating it from the five senses and from doing, from will.
When it's liberated from that, it's called Vivicha Kusalehi Dhammehi. Liberated from the five senses, liberated from the unwholesome states. It's called the first jhana. The first liberation. It's called liberating the mind. The 12th stage in Anapanasati is the achievement of jhanas. Now there's a question there. I will pause, because after jhanas, Anapanasati follows a slightly different path. Your question?
At that point, is the calming down more to do with the lower than the sense of will? Basically, I don't need to be melodramatic about this, but for me, I experience it like dying.
Correct? Because this is a point where, because you are the one who makes the nimitta move, you keep doing something. Doing is a consequence of will, of choosing, and managing. And that is an essential part of one's identity. The controller, the doer, the manager, the one who thinks, the one who's in charge, the one who chooses what you're going to eat for breakfast, the one who chooses what you're going to do. The opposite is called letting go. You're letting go of that very thing which chooses and does, which is called calming, peace, tranquility. The more calm you are, the less you can do. And it is a dying of that part of the self which is the manager, the doer, the will. I've given this talk before. I mentioned it earlier when I gave a talk at Singapore, when I talked about the will, people just couldn't sleep that night. This is how you experience the will disappearing. You have the guts to let go of control. And you realize that with the end of craving, temporarily, desire finishing, control, will, vanishing, you get the biggest hit of bliss in your life. The first jhana. Not only do you get the big hit of bliss, but you also get the big hit of insight, which is coming next. Can I continue? No, not yet.
Am I right in saying that I've almost got to accept? See, when I think about myself dying, okay, I have a certain emotion that comes to what it's
like. Correct. Okay. It's a sense of self which is dying, the atta. Your idea of who you are is being challenged and dying. Because you know when you die physically, it's just your body dies. But most people, even Christians, think that the soul, the real you, doesn't get destroyed that easily.
Well, I get the same feeling as that at that point in your
life. Absolutely.
Is that okay?
Absolutely. That's why my teacher, Ajahn Chah, he always used to ask us, have you come here to die? And he said, no, we don't know what he was saying. What do you mean, come here in this monastery to die? That's what he meant, to die, have the self die, or rather the illusion of the self die, to let go that much. And this is what happens naturally. And the point is, if you think about it, you might get afraid. But if you do it, this is so blissful. So you don't need to be afraid. Like many of your friends were afraid to come to India on pilgrimage. You heard all the horror stories, oh, you get sick. All sorts of things might happen to you. It's just so hard and tiring. You come here and it's wonderful. It's bliss. So all the horror stories from people never been. Certainly never been on one of the books course. This is first class. You don't get better than this. But the real, if you really meditate, you find it's not scary at all. There's bliss upon bliss upon bliss. It's worth dying. Take it on trust. Think of me. Die. Have you come with people to die? Come on, die.
The thing about it is, if you do succeed in letting go of that, then the next thing comes absolutely
bliss. Yeah,
that's right. It's just scary.
The bliss is very powerful. At the time, it's not scary. You're having a great time. This is the only way to describe it. It's like sexual orgasm, a million times stronger, and lasts a long time.
Imagine that. Sexual orgasm, a million times stronger, which lasts for many hours. And no bad side effects. Like babies. Now that's not a bad sort of description of what happened. This is called liberating the mind. That's why, whether you're afraid or not, the pleasure will bring you, pull you through. It's just too much sort of beauty, you let go. Now what happens next? Is it Anapanasati still? Yeah, go on. No. You're not focusing on the bliss. The bliss is just too strong. On the first four steps, you're focusing on the breathing. The next, you're focusing on the feeling of the breath. This is the Chitta Sankara. It becomes a mental experience of the breath. You're not just experiencing the breath through your body sense, you're experiencing it through your mind. Remember, there's six senses. In the same way you can smell food, you can also taste food. So when you're actually eating, what are you doing? Are you smelling it or are you tasting it? Are you seeing it? And it really depends on which is the most dominant. That's actually how you're experiencing the food. And when you come to the breath, you're either feeling it with your body, the body sense, first of all, but then it goes from the body sense to how the mind experiences the breath. And that's when you get to the Chitta Sankara, the pleasure and bliss, what I call the beautiful breath. There's a change here, you're not feeling on the body, you're feeling with the mind. So this is actually another way of looking at Anapanasati, a way of letting go of the body completely. You're experiencing the mind. So you have the breath felt by the body sense, first of all, by touch, then you feel it by mind, and then the mind dominates, the bliss dominates. It becomes just pure mind. And then the body is completely gone. Yeah. No, it's just a natural progression. So you don't think you're breathing in, you're breathing out. A natural progression, you just go deeply in. You don't realize you're breathing. It's only afterwards you realize that is how my mind knows the breath. And there's no in or out either. That distinction is completely gone. Just breathing. Just the phrase which the Buddha says, just to link it all together. Knowing it, whether it's short or long, knowing the whole body of the breath, calming that bodily formation, experiencing pitti, experiencing sukha, experiencing the whole mental formation, calming that mental formation down. And then experiencing the jitta, shining up the nimitta, calming the nimitta, releasing the mind. Jhana. Now what happens next, after you come out of jhanas? He trains, or one trains oneself thus. Breathing in and out, contemplating impermanence. That's number 13. Breathing in and out, contemplating fading away. Breathing in and out, contemplating cessation. Breathing in and out, contemplating relinquishing. Thus you train yourself. What does it really mean then? Is that according to that progression? When you emerge from the jhana, you just will see what has been impermanent. Something which had always been there has now disappeared. Several things, in fact. Number one, that which you said you were dying to, your will. I call it sometimes the potential to do. Because sometimes you think, well, I don't always exercise my will. I sometimes don't make a choice. But this is the potential to will. That's always there. In this moment, if you choose, you can get up, you can go, you can do whatever you want. The potential is all there. But in the jhanas, potential is gone. Something which you've never seen disappear yet in your life has now gone. You're fully aware that you can't move. This is scary, but when you come out, you realize that something is disappeared. Something which was constant. And I mentioned this is one of the meanings of Nitya. As a monk, we have this thing called Nitya food. Nitya food is if you come to our monastery every Monday, like Book does, when she's in town. She always comes to visit our monastery on Mondays. So because it's a constant, recurring time when she comes, that's called nitya food, constant food. That's one of the meanings. And the anicca means that something which was constant, which was always there, has now disappeared and vanished. Something which was constant in your life, which has never known it to disappear, which has always been there, now is no longer there. It's like the floor underneath you, completely disappearing. Wherever you've been, even in an aircraft, there's been a floor underneath you. There's always been, sort of, even in a swimming pool, there's a floor at the bottom somewhere, you know it's underneath you. But now there's no floor at all. Things which are basic have now disappeared. That's why it's impermanent. That's why it's completely changed the way you look at life. That's what I mean by anicca. The simile which I gave, it's not like waves on a lake. It's the whole lake disappears, as well as the mountains and the earth which contain it. Completely vanish into nothingness. That's anicca. See, fading away. You see the fading away of your body. It's a gradual process of the five senses fading into nothing. You sit down, you close your eyes, at first you see blackness, then it disappears. You feel your body. In deep meditation, you can't feel your body at all. It's completely faded away. Even your thinking has faded away. Completely disappeared. So much has disappeared. And it's so much bliss that it disappeared. You realize that fading away is nothing to be afraid of, but fading away is the best way to go. And if you get enough insight, you realize, well, you faded away so much, you get so much bliss. How about going the whole hog and fading away completely? So you do die, but not just the will die, even the knowing die, fading away completely. Which is the third of this last four, the 15th. Contemplating cessation, nirvana, things stopping, just like Angulimala, stop, but not just stop doing bad actions, stop even doing good actions, stop all actions, stop moving, stop being, cessation. At this point it's not scary, you've just been so blissed out. That bliss gives you immense courage to see what is hard to see, to go to places where most people would never dare to go to cessation. And lastly, contemplating relinquishment, giving up, letting go. You realize the more you have, the more pain and suffering there is for you. You just let go of a huge amount in your meditation, you've got huge bliss. You let go even more, you relinquish more. It's huge bliss. You see the path to nirvana is relinquishing. I don't mean relinquishing your money so the monks can become rich and fat. I don't mean relinquishing your possessions so you've got nothing. I mean relinquishing everything. Not just your possessions, but your body and also what you take to be your mind. Relinquishing the whole caboodle. Nothing left. Keeping nothing at all. And that's called letting go. Scary at first, but that's the Anapanasati. The 16 steps. That is powerful. And that was taught just around the corner. Bhikkhus, that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated. So it is of great fruit and great benefit. Let's carry on. And how, monks, does such mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness? Because on whatever occasion a monk breathes in long or out long, in short or out short, or breathes in and out, experiencing the whole body of the breath from the beginning to the end, or breathes out, tranquilizing the whole body of the breath, on that occasion a monk abides contemplating the body. Ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away the five hindrances. Because I say that this is a certain
body amongst the bodies, namely in and out breathing. It's part of the body. You're feeling it with the bodily feeling at that particular time. That's how you fulfill the first satipatthana, on the body. On whatever occasion a monk trains, I shall breathe in and out, experiencing rapture, pleasure, experiencing that mental formation of pleasure and bliss, that I train breathing in and out, tranquilizing that bodily mental formation. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the feelings, the Vedana, because pleasure and the bliss is the Vedana, it's a sensation. And so this is a certain feeling amongst the feelings, namely giving such close attention to the breath. As well, on that occasion, a monk abides contemplating feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. On whatever occasion a monk trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mind, or out experiencing the jitta, this is the nimitta, or you breathe in and out a gladdening, in other words shining up the nimitta, or stabilizing the nimitta, or liberating the mind, going into jhana. On that occasion a monk abides contemplating the mind, the jitta, the third satipatthana. So often that people say they do the third satipatthana, don't know what they're talking about, so they don't know what the jitta is. Certainly when you get to the state of nimitta, you've got a handle on what the Buddha means by the citta. It's also interesting, the word citta is also the word for beautiful, chitra. And actually you think many Sri Lankan ladies are called chitra? And then what does it mean? It means beautiful, delightful. This is what the mind is, this is what it's talking about, it's beautiful nimitta mind. So this is actually why it's called contemplating the mind. On whatever occasion a monk trains thus, I shall breathe in and out, contemplating impermanence, fading away, cessation and relinquishment. On that occasion a monk abides contemplating the mind objects, ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away the five hindrances. Having seen with wisdom the abandoning of the five hindrances, he closely looks on with equanimity. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. That is how mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas. And the word is fulfills, paripurna, means complete, absolute. So you don't need to do any more. So the anapanasati, people call it samatha, meditation sometimes. There's no difference between samatha and vipassana. The anapanasati fulfills the four satipatthana according to the word of the Buddha. So sometimes people ask you, what type of meditation do you do? You say anapanasati, and say, oh, samatha. Say, no, satipatthana. So always call anapanasati satipatthana. And you can quote the anapanasati sutra, quote the verse that the Buddha said. Fulfillment of the seven enlightenment factors. And how much does the four foundations of mindfulness develop and cultivate to fulfill the seven enlightenment factors? The seven enlightenment factors are just one way of both describing what enlightenment, the factors of enlightenment are, but also the path to enlightenment. When you fulfill these factors, you fulfill the enlightenment. Because on whatever occasion a monk abides contemplating the body, the first satipatthana, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factors arise in him. He develops it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. Sati, mindfulness, is the first enlightenment factor. Abiding thus mindful, investigates and examines that state with wisdom, embarks upon a full inquiry on it. On whatever occasion, abiding thus mindful, person investigates and examines that state with wisdom. On that time, occasion, the investigation of states, done with which enlightenment factors arise in them. You develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment, which is the second enlightenment factor, investigation of dhammas. In one who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it, tireless energy is aroused. In other words, with the mindfulness and the investigation, that's where energy can come from. On whatever occasion tireless energy is aroused in someone who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it, on that occasion, the energy, virya, enlightenment factor, is aroused in them. They develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in him.
I just mentioned that third word, Virya. You may have heard a similar word when we were around Rajaga, Vira, which is Mahavira, the leader of the Jains. The reason why it's called Mahavira was great hero. The word for hero was Vira. And the Virya is connected to that. So it's not just ordinary effort, it's heroic effort. The heroic effort to die as you go into jhana. You have to be heroic to become enlightened. And that's what Virya means. It's not just ordinary effort, heroic effort. That's where the Virya comes from. In one who has aroused energy, unworldly rapture arises. Pity. On whatever occasion unworldly rapture arises in a monk who has aroused energy, on that occasion the rapture enlightenment factor is aroused in them. And he develops it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in them. Unworldly. Not just worldly rapture, like you get your favourite food, or you know, you go and see your favourite movie on the TV, or your favourite music. So when you go home, the first thing you do, I'm going to put my favourite food, I'm going to have song down when I get back, you know, favourite Thai food, I'm going to have whatever your favourite food is when you get back home. That is worldly rapture. This is unworldly stuff. And in one who is rapturous, the body and mind becomes tranquil. Whatever occasion the body and the mind become tranquil in the monk who is rapturous, on that occasion the tranquility and enlightenment factor is aroused in them. And you develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. The tranquility of the body and the tranquility of the mind. That particular tranquility of the body, when the body is so at ease, you just leave it alone. You experience that in your meditation when you're sitting so still. You don't have to hold the body still at all. It's just so tranquil, it just completely disappears. It's bodily tranquility. And mental tranquility is when the mind is so still. It can hardly think. It doesn't think at all. It's so still. That's it. In one who is tranquil, another phrase not in here is somebody who feels tranquil experiences sukha, happiness. But this is actually implied here. On the next stage, it says, in one who is body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated, samadhi. On whatever occasion the mind becomes samadhi, in someone whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, on that occasion, the samadhi enlightenment factor is aroused in them, and they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in them. Only when there's pleasure there, sukha, happiness, can get samadhi. This is one of my most important, not my most important teachings, one of the things I picked up from the Buddha, from my teachers. The mind enters samadhi from happiness. If there's no happiness, you'll never get samadhi. If you're having a hard time, you're pushing through things, I'm going to get this samadhi no matter what. That's not the way. The way samadhi is, oh, it's so nice, so beautiful, oh, this is so good. That's where samadhi comes from. From bliss, not from force.
And one who looks closely or with equanimity at the mind thus concentrates, after concentration. On that occasion, the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused in them. And they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. And so it's the same with all the other contemplations. This is actually how the seven enlightenment factors are aroused. And monks. How monks do the seven enlightenment factors develop and cultivate and fulfill true knowledge and deliverance? Here a monk develops this mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, viveka, that's jhana, dispassion and cessation, and arrives in relinquishing. Develops investigation of states, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, equanimity, which is supported by the seclusion. Two types of seclusion. The physical seclusion is going to quiet places. The chitta viveka, the name of Ajahn Sumedho's first monastery in Sussex, is mental seclusion, always means jhana. Viveka sukha, or paviveka sukha, is the explanation description of first jhana. Bhikkhus. That is how the seven enlightenment factors developed and cultivated. Fulfill true knowledge and deliverance, otherwise known as full enlightenment. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. The teaching on Anapanasati, this huge, powerful, great teaching, one of my favourites, first said, just the stones go away from here, the Sarvati. That's why it's so powerful to repeat it in this place. Any questions about the Anapanasati Sutta? Okay, now I don't know about you, I was tired before, but I'm not tired now. I'm full of hope. So, those of you who wish to sit meditation, I've given you instructions already while the Buddha has. You can sit and meditate. There's going to be no bells, no end in this meditation. You can sit however long you like. Just mention to people, those of you who are going to meditate a long time, breakfast is at 7 o'clock. So please come out by 7. There'll be no wake up call tomorrow morning. 7 a.m. breakfast, 8 o'clock. We go to the Chaitra Ground, where many other amazing things happen, I'm going to talk about tomorrow. As for now, free time, if you want to meditate, meditate, whatever length of time. I'm not going to ring the gong, no one else is going to ring anything. So see you tomorrow morning.